All right, you're all set.
Great. Well, also good morning to you. Looking forward to this webinar. I'm just going to have a brief intro and introduce my friend and hero, Marilyn Bartlett. As some of you may know, she was named one of the 50 world's great leaders for her work that she's done in Montana. This is a list with people like Bill Gates. So real pleased to have her on this morning. And, you know, what you're going to hear from Marilyn is both extraordinary and ordinary at the same time. I mean, the kind of politics and some of what's going on there is extraordinary, although there's a bunch of states that are wanting to follow in her, in Montana's footsteps. On the other hand, you know, a lot of what she's doing, employers all over the country are doing. And so it's another context where it can be done. And at the end of the day, what's so great is it's, you know, what she's doing and what's going on around is reversing 20 years of wage stagnation and decline for the working and middle class. And it's people like Marilyn who are changing that. And that's the reality of how things are happening in healthcare. You know, when people take the bull by the horns, it's quite straightforward to do. And so with that, I want to pass a baton to Marilyn, and she's going to have a presentation that I think you'll enjoy. And you'll get a lot out of it, and looking forward to hearing her speak. So take it away, Marilyn.
Well, thank you, Dave. Thank you so much. And I want to thank you and your Health Rosetta team. It's a pleasure working with you. And I have enjoyed learning from you and support the directions that you and your team are going. Today I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what I did at the State of Montana Health Plan, but a lot about other things that are going on with employers across the nation. When I was administrator of the State of Montana Employee Health Plan, we had about 31,000 lives. The plan self-funded for medical, dental, pharmacy, vision, and is the largest self-funded plan in Montana, which isn't surprising. In a lot of states, the state employee or public employee plan may be the largest. We have 5 on-site employee health centers. I was the administrator there until June 2018 for about 3.5 years. And then I am now the special project coordinator with the insurance commissioner for the state of Montana. So what happened? The driving force behind the changes was the financial position of the plan. When you look at this chart, you'll see what the actuary projected for the plan reserves. When I took the job in late 2014, this was the actuarial projection that was presented to the legislature and the governor's office. And it projected reserves would be at minus $9 million in December 2017. So the legislature took action with Montana Senate Bill 418 during the 2015 legislative session. And it basically said the health plan needed to right the ship, that we needed to take actions to bring those reserves to a required balance. And it also made contingent any employee pay raises on how the health plan did. So we had our marching orders from the legislature, from the unions, from the governor's office, that we needed to deal with cost containment and yet secure the benefits and the care for employees at the same time. So the first thing I did was to dig in, where were the costs? And this was not an easy task. It was really hard for me to get to the data. We did not have a data warehouse. We were having problems getting the data from the vendors. So what I did was use the actuaries database, which was just an Access database, and we used it in conjunction with Excel to try to figure out where the costs were. 43% of our costs were with the Montana hospital facilities. And what's interesting is 87% of that blue chunk was attributable to the 11 acute care hospitals within Montana, and only 13% of that amount pertained to the critical access hospitals. I also looked at the pharmacy section being at 8%. From my experience, I knew that there would be potential savings there. I mentioned our health centers. They are only 3% of the cost, and yet they're strongly focused on primary care, chronic care management, health coaching, and I really wanted to increase the focus on that. So my initial efforts went to the Montana hospital facilities, the pharmacy, and the health centers. So one thing that had always bothered me is that price. Price is the issue. Now, this was a chart that I was using during my implementations in 2015-16. It's done by the Healthcare Cost Institute of employer-sponsored plans. And the interesting statistic is, look at the orange line. Utilization and intensity for inpatient declined from 2012 to 2016. But look at that blue line. The price just continues to go up. On outpatient, we saw basically a level. It dropped but came back up on utilization and intensity. But look at that price decrease. And I still contend that price is the issue. So what I did with our data is I took a look at the hospital semi-private board and room, because there are not a lot of outliers in these charges. It's a fairly easy measurement to do. And I worked with our actuary to do this chart. I wanted to be able to show what happens when you use the traditional network of billed less discount. You can see the blue line is what was charged by the hospitals, and the green line shows what was allowed under our contracts. So yes, maybe we could get a 15% discount from one particular provider network versus a 10% for another. But we're going to follow that same trend. We're going to have prices keep going up and up and up. And we have no control over that. The charge master that a hospital uses is really under their control. It's not public information, and it can be changed at any time. Similarly, the allowed amount is a negotiated amount between a network provider or a carrier to what discount they will get off that charge amount. Those are confidential and proprietary documents. So why would we agree to pay something on a price we have no control over and is not public, that is reduced by a negotiated amount that is secret and we have no part of the negotiations? That never made sense to me. So I started looking at Medicare, and this was a chart that I used quite a bit during our studies. And the blue dotted line shows what Medicare paid for the full, now the one before I just showed the hospital room, this is for the full inpatient stay inflation adjusted. And the blue line shows that Medicare reimbursement was fairly stable. I then studied the MedPAC reporting, the MedPAC calculations, the Medicare cost reports with the hospitals, and their methodology is geared at reimbursing hospitals at their cost plus 8%, and it's variable cost plus 8%. And one can argue, well, Medicare doesn't reimburse enough, but when you dig in, you could see that they, in Montana anyway, they were reimbursing about 87% of the cost for our 11 large hospitals. But look at that red line. This is what has increased the price to the private market. So I wanted to dig in there a little bit more. In the end, we decided our goal would be a fair, transparent hospital reimbursement. Our goal would be Montana hospital reimbursement as a markup of Medicare for all facility services. So this would include infusibles, it would include the medical devices, joint replacements, you name it. We knew there would be crosswalks we'd have to do for items that Medicare doesn't cover in extensive guides such as maternity, pediatrics. We knew that. But why did we select Medicare as a reference point? We felt it's a common reference and it overcomes the variation in charge masters in differences in billing prices. is the largest healthcare payer in the world. The prices and methods are empirically based. They're adjusted for geography, risk. The methods are easy. They're transparent. They're intended to be fair, and they also are implementing quality measures and value-based payments into their methodology. Now, I established Montana requirements based on working with the executive branch and the legislative branch. We preferred no balance billing, so we did contracting with each hospital. We did not do what people normally think of as reference-based pricing. You pay a reimbursement amount that you feel is fair, and then the member is open to balance billing. We did not want that, so we wanted contracting. We preferred no steerage or narrow network. It was very clear that we were working with taxpayer dollars. Taxpayers work at all facilities, whether they're not-for-profit or not, and we felt we did not want to do that. So we knew that we were broadening those parameters, and that would lose negotiating power for us, so we would have to reimburse at a higher level. If we could do narrow networks and just pick one or two hospitals, especially in the two hospital cities, pick one, we were offered much lower rates. But we did not go with that. We wanted every hospital in the network if we could. We needed quick financial results. We were in financial trouble. We wanted control over future reimbursement increases. This was really important to me, to tie a reimbursement rate to Medicare. Let me know that we had some control over the future increases that would either be dependent upon Medicare going up by their annual adjustment or if we renegotiated contracts. Now, I also had state procurement regulations, and I was not able to build the network on my own. I could not do direct contracting with facilities unless I went through full RFP processes. So we did an RFP for a third-party administrator or a carrier that offers ASC services to help us build that network. It would be for our plan, and we would help with the negotiations and be very much a part of it, but we could not carry those contracts. So that's what we decided to do. So immediately as we rolled out, we had a lot of opposition. Insurance carriers were very opposed. We were disrupting their standard provider networks. Hospitals, we were disrupting their payment model, and they were losing control of charges. And they were concerned, what's going to happen to us? This is a whole different method. Brokers, I was surprised at that one. We were disrupting the market. We were disrupting the whole reimbursement options that are given to an employer group. I suddenly found legislators who wanted us to lower the costs also sit on the hospital boards, and so had a different hat on that suddenly weren't supporting what we were doing. Of course, the Montana Hospital Association, the different associations of providers were very concerned and very opposed. We tried to keep the dialogue as open as we could. We were very public on what we were doing, and we would try to keep all stakeholders involved. But what I did realize is there comes a point when you can't do something through consensus, and you had to keep your goal in mind and do what was best for the plan. So what did we do? We terminated our current carrier contract. We issued an RFP, and we asked for these reference-based contracting solutions and stated what we wanted. Of the 9 respondents, only one said, we'll work with you, and we actually have the data to support this initiative. So we contracted with Allegiance, a TPA out of Montana, and which really has more clients nationwide. And we formed a partnership. What Allegiance did was really help us with the data. They were able to engage a Medicare repricer and run our data through a Medicare repricer to see where we were falling as a percent of Medicare and help us with our contracting. on our side, we really were digging into hospital billing and hospital financing or financials. Would the hospitals really lose money? So I launched my investigation into what really is in uncompensated care that hospitals report. Are they reporting the discounts given to insurers as uncompensated care? Are they reporting the difference between Medicaid reimbursements and billed charges as uncompensated care? I needed to really know where they were coming from. So I dug deeply into the Medicare cost reports and learned those. I also dug into Medicaid. I was able to really figure out the CMS supplemental payments that are going to Medicaid that really help Medicaid reimbursement. So when the hospitals would say they only reimburse 40% of expenses, I really knew my numbers. I knew in some cases where Medicaid was reimbursing more than Medicare through these supplemental payments. I also started digging into 340B. That's where the not-for-profit hospitals, if they have registered, are able to be considered a covered entity, buy drugs at 340B low prices, and sell them to in an outpatient pharmacy setting. And we had some of those situations through our health plan where we were reimbursing outpatient drugs at a hospital pharmacy for our contracted rate. And I was able to dig in a little bit more and see where that profit is and get a little bit picture where the hospitals are coming from. So this is what the data analysis showed us. On outpatient costs, this shows the 11 acute care hospitals, and our data showed where they were falling as a percent of Medicare. Now, we knew that this was going to be a new program. It was new to the hospitals. We were understanding that they were kind of wondering how much risk there was. So we drew a line at 250% of Medicare. We said, you know, let's go, if we could get agreements in place that were with a range that would cap at 250% of Medicare, what kind of savings would we have? And what would these hospitals have to go through? And you'll see that four were already there. So our strategy wasn't setting what we thought the reasonable price was, different than you're seeing maybe in other states and what other plans are doing. We took a just different approach of what do we think we could do that would get us our goal and yet be less disruptive. We did the same on the inpatient, and you can see the range here. And for that, we drew a line really around 220 to 225. So this became our strategy. This is blended inpatient, outpatient costs. And this is what we were working with. We saw that range. And what if we could just get that range down into the lower areas? And some of those hospitals that were at the higher end, understandably, they were concerned and they needed a glide path. What if they could have 2 years to slowly ratchet in? And that was fine with us because we wanted to make sure we had the system in place where we had more control over the future and could get it some immediate savings. And they had to make a pretty big dip that first year. We immediately had two hospitals come online, and it was interesting because those two hospitals were the lowest cost and highest quality. And they helped us very much figure out how we were going to model some of the maternity, how we were going to process claims, what we were going to do. And Allegiance was a great partner, it still is, and worked with us through this whole process. We decided what we would do is send the claims as they came in right to an independent Medicare repricer who would reprice the claims, send them back at what the value was at 100% of Medicare, and then the TPA would mark it up to the agreed upon contractual rate. The next thing we did was really focus on pharmacy. It was 18% of our plan cost, and our product was actually done through a purchasing cooperative. And the purchasing cooperative held six contracts. One, these lists some of them with the PBM, the rebate aggregator, specialty, mail order, case management, data analytics. So there were a lot of different contracts. We were able to get copies of only four of the contracts, and I delved into those. We worked a lot. Then we contracted with Alliant to be our consultant. They're very skilled in pharmacy data too. And we found that although we thought we had a transparent pass-through product, we had spread pricing. We also had a cap on the rebates. The rebate aggregator, the contract said that we were guaranteed $22.13 per rebate. And then I also found that when the rebates went to the purchasing co-op, they allocated rebates based on how long members had been in and some other algorithms. So we decided that was not the product for us. We terminated that contract. We contracted for a transparent pass-through PBM, and where we would receive 100% of the rebates. We had expanded auditability, and there would be no spread pricing. I also put in one MAC list, which meant that the amount that we paid for the drug would be the exact same amount the pharmacy got. And I put in one list, so every pharmacy was paid the same for that one particular drug. Immediately, CVS said, no, we demand higher reimbursement. So I kicked CVS out of the network, and that immediately saved us $1.6 million. They're still out of the network. We saved $7.4 million the first year. And for you employers that have retirees on your plan, we moved from the RDS system to the AGWIP, the Employer Group Waiver Plan, and saved $2.8 million. That particular plan allows you to actually issue what is kind of a Part D plan. So when the member gets into that donut hole area, you receive higher pharma rebates, plus then after that you're able to get some CMS reinsurance. And surprising to me, we ended up paying less in administrative fees. I expected we'd pay more because the PBM was no longer keeping the spread pricing or portion of the rebates, but we paid less in administrative fees. Now, with some of that savings, we wanted to implement a medication therapy management program, but we did not want a standard commercial plan where members receive letters, mailings. We wanted some more personal touch. So it took us a while. We did a collaborative effort with the Montana Independent Pharmacists, the University of Montana Pharmacy School, our PBM, which is Navitus, and our on-site health centers. And what we were able to do there was come up with a joint collaborative effort where the entity called Hometown MTMs are able to use their software to identify members that either are not adherent or have medications that may be conflicting, or maybe there's a different medication program. And they're reaching out to those members. They may come into the health center to meet with a pharmacy student. They may go reach out to their Montana Independent Pharmacist in Culbertson, Montana, or the pharmacy students will reach out to them via phone and then work with their physician to get their drug plan going better. Now, we haven't had it in place for over a year yet, but so far the indications are it's going very well. Now, really important is primary health care. I have a quote here from Health Affairs, and primary care really does benefit the members. It's lower cost to the plan, but it's the best management of chronic diseases. It lowers your health care costs and a high level of satisfaction with their care. We have 5 Montana health centers in 5 different cities that are focused on primary care, preventive care, chronic care management. It's operated by a vendor, a third-party vendor, and members are able to go to the health center with zero copay. There are also contracts in place for labs and radiology where the member pays nothing because the contracts really are so good. So we removed any barriers to access that members could get into these health centers for their care. And where they're located, they service 73% of our plan members. And they were only 3% of our plan costs. But I wanted to put actually more money into this area because I think the information's out there that good primary care and getting rid of those old systems of going to a clinic doctor that particularly hospital-owned clinics, where you go in, you have your seven-minute appointment, you're immediately referred to a specialist, you're having more tests, you don't form that relationship, and costs go up, aren't having good results. So we did see a decrease in specialty care. It was almost like the gateway into other healthcare. Now, it's interesting because I think you're seeing this nationwide that primary care really does need to be the focus. I was asked to testify at the Senate hearing on the Lower Healthcare Cost Act in Washington, D.C., and I just received a question from the committee asking me what I felt the most important step forward would be that would manage healthcare costs and would improve member health. And I answered it with two things. I answered it with enhanced primary care. I'm a stronger believer in DPC, direct primary care. You're seeing it crop up. Every state now has some direct primary care entities. Montana has five. And it is where the member can pay a monthly fee and have access to a provider for a broad array of primary care, health coaching, tests, you name it. We in Montana, our insurance commissioner did issue a letter of authority to state that DPC is not insurance. DPC is a method of health care. So we're seeing those go up, and there's a lot that can be done at the federal level to enhance that, and we're working towards that. And of course, on-site health centers are really critical too. Now, we had physicians, mid-levels, nurses, health coaches, a behavioral health coach, a exercise physiologist, so that a member can go to the health center. They have their screenings, and the provider can refer them to health coaches to manage their chronic conditions. We implemented a diabetic care club in conjunction with our MTM program, where the member is able to get good coaching and good care along with their required medical expenses. So what happens? We were supposed to be at minus $9 million in reserves by December 2017, but we weren't. We were at $112 million in reserves. And what we basically did was pull money out of the system and get it back into the reserves of the plan. Now, there were no rate increases for employees for 2017 through 2019, and there are no rate increases projected for 2020 and 2021. And the benefits are pretty much the same. I think we haven't been raising any of the out-of-pockets. But a couple of things, if any of accountants are out there, or people with state, city, or government plans, OPEB liability is a big issue. This is the liability on the books for what retirees will cost when they retire, and the expense must be booked on the balance sheet anyway for while the person's working. Now, in 2015, our projection was $374 million, and it's an unfunded liability, and the rating agencies in New York did not look on that fondly. We were able to reduce that OPEB liability to $54 million by 2017. A lot of that is that we had lower cost. It's a lower cost plan. It's no longer considered a $210 million a year plan. It's down to $170 million a year plan. But we also had control over future costs. So that was a success for our governor's office. Now, what I didn't expect is that our health plan reserves would be larger than the Montana General Fund in 2017. And that summer, we were able to lend money to the general fund, and they paid interest, and that was fine. A legislative special session was then held at the end of 2017, and Senate Bill 3 was passed for to have a $25 million employer premium holiday that would benefit the state budget. So that taxpayer money was able to go back into other areas. It did reduce the reserves, but the reserves were still way over what was required, and the plan still is managing with that in mind, knowing that $25 million was taken out. That does put pressure on the plan to move forward. I'd like to give some final thoughts. As an employer, to never forget about the fiduciary role. The plan fiduciary administers or manages the health plan with discretion over the plan assets. Now, a lot of this is in ERISA law if you're a self-funded employer plan with a private employer, or in trust law if you have a trust. You really are responsible for how every dollar is spent. And I took my role very seriously that I had to cut out spending that was not appropriate. I had to manage the department spending to quit stacking wellness products. We had four contracts. I cut three of them out. You're really responsible for every penny. Now, as a public employee plan, you're governed by state law, then CMS and HHS as a non-federal government employee plan. Now, we're seeing class action lawsuits. There are several out there. They're interesting lawsuits to me. There's one that was settled out of court, and 231 plan administrators were cited, as well as the plans. And that was an interesting issue because it's where the carrier had network savings they were paying themselves. So it would be a wrap network for shared savings, and the carrier collected a part of that shared savings. And it was difficult because as a plan administrator, you don't get to see those contracts. You don't see the contract that a large carrier has with a vendor, such as a chiropractic network. You don't get to see that. But you better be scrutinizing your claims runs to see anything that looks a little bit strange that maybe is an admin fee paid outside of that. I have some other thoughts. I'm seeing some very interesting things with employer purchasing cooperatives. I'm working with two different states with their employer purchasing cooperatives that are doing some very, very interesting things. What they're finding is a lot of these employer forums have been made up over the years of vendors. So you will have your large carriers, you'll have PBMs, you'll have brokers, you'll have employers all coming together to the table. And they've worked fairly well on quality measures and things that are very important. But when it gets into the realm of talking about cutting costs or more transparency in costs, it gets a little tough because you'll have the vendors that have vested interests in that having different opinions. You'll have hospitals that have different opinions, your large carriers. It gets a little difficult to start addressing that. There are, Colorado just passed a law that is allowing for a purchasing co-op. So you'll see that the Colorado Business Group on Health is doing some very innovative things, and they'll be coming out very shortly with their hospital value report, where they have compared the RAM 2.0 study on cost with quality metrics that come from Quantros and CareChecks on what is a true hospital value. And they're going to be carving out a section just to get into employer purchasing. It's critical to find the right partners. Your contracts need to be transparent. You need to know what you're paying. You need to be independent. When I did my broker contract with Alliant, it does not allow them to make any commissions on any products. They can have no indirect or direct compensation from any vendors. I needed them to have my back and be my consultant. I can't say enough how much you need to get into your data and analytics. I do, Alliant was very helpful to us, but we have gone as a state plan with our own data warehouse. I'm often asked, what do you think about legislative versus contracting solutions? I go for contracting solutions. As an employer, you can do direct contracting on your own. You can look for contracting solutions. Now, be prepared for opposition. There are political influences. I had insurance companies. I had hospitals. I had brokers. I had so many people going to the governor's office and legislators to kill what we were doing. There's resistance to change, and then every vendor or middleman has a product or solution to sell, and you have to scrutinize that very closely, but don't give up. In the end, I think price is the issue, and don't ever lose your focus on price. This is an updated chart from the Healthcare Cost Institute, like the first one I showed you, but this was just recently published. And I want you to look at these charts. Look on the left. The utilization is the dotted lines. Utilization is still fairly stable. The green line is pharmaceuticals, and that has gone up. But utilization is still fairly flat. But look at those prices. The straight lines show you that regardless of utilization being down, prices are going up. And I claim that's the reason healthcare is going up. So don't lose your focus on price. Now, you're going to have a lot of brokers. You're going to have a lot of insurance companies say, no, you need value-based. You need value-based. Don't lose sight of price being a part of value. Now, this, I wish I could take claim on this formula, but I can't. It comes from another state. And this is being adopted by a lot of employer health plans and employer forums. That value is really quality over price. As quality goes up, then price can go up. But as quality falls, price needs to go down. And there's a little more complicated formula that they have developed that factors in utilization. So I think one of the tenets of value-based is to really learn what is it, what are they saying, what are they selling, and how will that help your price. And those are my opinions. So I'm done with my part of the show, Dave, and I hope that it's been helpful.
Yes, thanks so much, Marilyn. That was very helpful. And there's a Q&A box for folks who want to submit questions, and Melissa and I will kind of juggle back and forth as questions come in. But I have some follow-up questions for you. Marshall Allen, who you know, he did a great profile on your work in Montana, actually published a piece this morning, I believe it was, and it was talking about fraud, you know, and it's quite a story and really shined a light on something I wrote about in my last book that unfortunately when it's, you're in a self-insured plan, which about two-thirds of the workforce the administrators, typically carriers, are spending your money, and it really shines a light on how they're really not focused in on stopping fraud, and it's so such a blatant story that they have there. And so I'm curious, obviously you've been tackling two of the really big areas in terms of, you know, hospital costs and drug costs and whatnot. And of course, those are the great places to start. But curious whether you've thought at all about the fraud issue. You know, like in that story, it showed how easy it was to set up a MPI number, the National Provider Index, which basically you have to have if you're going to bill Medicare and kind of by extension carriers, and you know, CMS has no authority to verify. So pretty much anybody can set up the MPI number, as the story goes into. So curious, you know, given that the FBI and Accenture estimate that about 10% of all healthcare spending is on fraud, have you thought about that as an area you may delve into in the future?
Oh, thank you, Dave. That's a really good question. I did read Marshall's article this morning. Oh, it is excellent. And I think he points out one thing very strongly that I have found just in my experience is that he cites three of the large carriers as not really paying that much attention to fraud, waste, and abuse. And I would concur with that. One of the carriers, a large carrier we had, I hired a specific claims auditor, and I wanted to her to audit claims, and she looked for potential fraud, waste, and abuse. And many times she would find things that, that the carrier didn't. We had a particular case with this carrier where over $800,000 was spent on a particular drug, and it was not legit, we felt. And we pushed the carrier to dig in, and we got nowhere. So it kind of wasn't surprising to me that Marshall's article showed the lack of responsiveness. I'm also been interested at being at the insurance commissioner's office and finding that there's not, I believe that insurance carriers, TPAs, are required to report potential fraud, but we don't see much of that coming in. So it is an area I am very, very, very much interested in, and I know it's an area that we're starting to really explore here at the insurance commissioner's office. I don't have a lot of knowledge on it. You and Marshall have way more than I do, but it is a serious problem. I have been working closely with the FTC on a couple of particular issues that have to do more with antitrust collusion. And to me, that definitely is part of fraud. And it is, I see that there is a regulatory level that can help all of us out, but sometimes that's very slow to move. I also find in place some laws that kind of prevent FTC from looking at certain things. So it's a big regulatory issue, but then I also think it's a big issue within the person or the firm that you're paying to adjudicate your claims correctly. And the tough part is it boils down to you, the fiduciary, that you're responsible for all those dollars to be spent well, and you're contracting for it to be done. So I would urge you in your contracts with your carrier, with your TPA, to really beef up your language on that fraud, waste, and abuse with what expectations are. And then when you do get an auditor in for an independent audit, beef up their audit of it.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, you know, there's a case I'm aware of where, you know, it's quite clear that there wasn't proper attention paid to fraud, and the carrier's response that was administering the plan was, well, you know, it's kind of your fault. You talking to the employer, you haven't even, this is a company that had between 2 and 3 million claims a year, and in their agreement with the carrier to administer their plan, they were only able to audit 200 claims a year, which is a pretty ridiculous thing that they agreed to, although I don't think it's unique, and they weren't even doing that. And so that, you know, I don't think that lets the carrier off the hook, but that was kind of their argument. And so, you know, certainly even if you have such a light auditability, 200 claims a year is pretty absurd when you have 2 million claims a year, certainly take advantage of that. And you'll find there's a lot of issues and just some pretty remarkable things. That's why I devoted a whole chapter to it in my book. The other thing I want to kind of comment and a question is, you know, you pointed out the difference between the utilization and the price. And one of the things I remind people to do is to, you know, if they know any doctors or nurses, you know, ask them if they're being paid radically different than they were, you know, 10 years ago or whatever. And what you'll find is, you know, pretty much their pay has just trended with inflation. And so there's a big difference between price and cost. You know, the actual costs of healthcare haven't gone up much in terms of, you know, the clinicians. It's the price that's gone up. And so what's your experience been with outside of the hospital arena? Are the independent medical practices, are they fine with those Medicare plus rates? Are you finding any reaction one way or another there?
They're fine with them. In fact, the provider rates, we did 165% of Medicare, and nobody got a drop except those that were owned by the hospitals. The independents, most of them got an increase. I think it's interesting to look at what's going on in North Carolina. The state health plan there through Treasurer Folwell has stated what they will reimburse providers. And they have 11,000 independent providers that have already signed on. And they are very pleased with the program and will receive reimbursement. They have no hospitals or hospital providers that have signed on. And that's much more of a political and a different issue. But the providers, the independent providers, were fine with our reimbursement. And going to the model which we talked about, you and I have talked about, with direct primary care, that is really booming, where the member pays $65 a month, and sometimes it's 24/7 access to a you know, through Skype with your doctor. And we're finding that it's really getting really, you know, good traction. But then we're running into issues of hospitals not allowing admitting privileges to those doctors. We're running into, you can't really have a hybrid solution where that provider could also work under an insurance network. So there's some disruption there. But as far as the basic question, the independent providers and even the standalone surgery centers were fine with the reimbursement.
Yeah, that's what we're finding around the country as well, is that, you know, in many cases, you say it's actually a pay increase for the medical practices. And so it's quite well received. And so that's good to hear. It's the case in Montana as well. And then, you know, you mentioned primary care, and you mentioned health coaches. That's something that I would, again, emphasize. And then I'll have a question, is people tend to think of primary care as just addressing kind of little acute issues because we've badly undermined it and just kind of turned it into a referral machine. And so the other two pillars of proper primary care, you mentioned one, which is things like health coaches. How do you address kind of lifestyle-driven disease? You know, some people believe that 80% of the chronic conditions are due to lifestyle. And so health coaches can prove to be very effective there. The other one that's often forgotten, and I wonder in your health centers, is when you have a complex medical condition, we know that in any given year, typically 5 to 8% of the members will consume 50 to 80% of the dollars. And so getting an individual who has, say, a need for potentially an organ transplant or a cancer or something like that, do these on-site health centers, do they help coordinate any of the care when you have these complex conditions, and are they involved at all in that?
That's a really good question. And I think when I left the health plan, we were trying to move to that role of hiring care coordinators. Just as simple as being able to say a person's been admitted to the hospital, but that doctor doesn't have admitting privileges, so a hospitalist at the hospital is taking care of them. And that's okay, but how do they coordinate that care? We didn't quite get to that point. I really do think that is the right solution. What we did was that then moved into the TPA, so the third party administrator, through their care management, and we had a care management nurse on staff. They would do the coordinated care for any of these large cases and use centers of excellence, some of them out of state, to be able to help manage those care. I agree with you totally, Dave. That's a critical role. We didn't get there, but I totally support what you're saying, and that's the place to do it. The member already has a relationship built with the providers and with the health coaches at the health center. They've trusted them, they've worked with them, and they would like them overseeing and coordinating that care. So that's a model I totally support, but we did not put that in place.
Yeah, I think that's, you do find that with some of the on-site clinic providers, they will have a little narrower scope than, say, the direct primary care docs that you mentioned. So you definitely need to do your homework, you know, on these in terms of, I know that was something you inherited, but it's something that's important for others to look into. Melissa, you know, why don't you feather in some questions that may, you know, be out there from the attendees. Are there any questions you want to, I know I have some more, but I want to make sure that any questions addressed.
We have a couple. So the first one is, how difficult was it to get the employees to see the new plan as a good thing versus the propaganda of the opposition that the new plan would reduce quality? And the other thing I hear frequently is access.
Boy, that is an excellent question, and that is a real issue. The employees in our situation, the employees were mad already at me because they didn't get a very good pay raise because the health plan was in bad shape. So they were already mad. And what I did is I worked with our union leadership because about 63% of the employees are members of the union. And I worked with the union leadership and they helped me. They were able to help shift that anger towards what was driving the costs. And in the end, when we had one particular hospital hold out and not sign up, they really mobilized the union members into writing postcards, calling the CEOs, CFOs. They really, really helped me. And it's a tough line to follow. I started off with really pulling together a group of employees, and that didn't work. I just had a lot of venting and a lot of anger. So we kept communication going, and we, Allegiance, contracted with a marketing firm out of Atlanta, Georgia, to help do videos and instructional meetings we could do to tell employees what this was going to do, show them the projections. We made promises that if we pull this off, you know, rates are going to go be stable. And so we did a lot of that education, and then we worked with the union leadership to kind of help motivate them. But as you well know, employees can be really adverse to change, and employees have never really had to deal with healthcare costs that much before. We don't have a high deductible health plan. And so much of the hospital costs, the drug costs, things are just behind the scenes. They pay their copay, coinsurance, and they don't really see the rest of that. And trying to educate them, we never got there because it kind of got boring, but we tried to make it personal to employees. We can make a commitment to you if you'll help us get this done. And I realize there's a risk in that, in saying, you know, your premiums will be stable, and the legislature has said they'll come back and give a higher pay raise in 2017 if we can get this done. So, and the legislature did do that. They did come through. So I wish I had a good answer. I would say very controlled communication at the level that to get their buy-in, that there's something in it for them. And then if there are employer groups, I know North Carolina is working a lot with their employee association, the state employee association, and that's only 50,000 of their 727,000 members. But if you can mobilize that group to your support. But it's tough because you're dealing against fear-mongering of hospitals saying, well, we're going to have to close. Or insurance companies saying, oh, you're just worried about the price. You're not worried about quality. Quality is going to decrease because price. And you're up against the horrible, horrible opposition. And luckily, Allegiance hired a marketing firm to help us. Dave, you might have some better answers to that because that's a really good question.
Yeah, I'd add a couple things. Those are all great points. You'll see variance depending. If it's a public sector or union plan, generally these are richer plans. And what they haven't seen is that their wages have been held back by healthcare cost growth. So there's somewhat blind to that sometimes. And so there can be pushback and, you know, this kind of education, you know, and it can be turned around, you know, and I've seen that in a number of cases where unions end up becoming the biggest ally in this, and they have a tremendous ability to mobilize. You know, the good news in air quotes is when you get into the private sector, you know, the vast majority, I mean, now people are calling under a $1,500 deductible, a quote, low deductible. And high deductible being over 3,000. I mean, it wasn't that long ago where deductibles were, you know, maybe a few hundred dollars. And so the, you know, you can deliver a pretty strong story there. Particularly one of the areas that's a big area of fear mongering is this notion of balanced billing. You spoke to that, you know, earlier, Marilyn, about how you want to contract and get rid of that. And that's what you see that's maybe to the surprise of some folks is we've done analysis where we see balanced billing of, you know, about a 1.5% on PPO, you know, kind of traditional plans, and in a well-implemented reference-based plan, and I emphasize well-implemented because there's some pretty clumsy ones out there, but in a well-implemented reference-based pricing plan, the balance billing is like 0.5%, and then it just ends up becoming a negotiation. You've just got to communicate with the employee, hey, if you get this issue, let us know, you know, and we'll get on it. So that's something there that can be communicated. So I want to be respectful of everybody's time. I know there's probably going to be some more questions. We're certainly available, you know, via our website, healthrosetta.org, and on social media and LinkedIn. You know, I'm certainly out there. So we're going to post this and this video of the webinar and make it available for folks who weren't able to attend. If you know somebody who should have, you know, let us know, sign up through some of the channels that we have, and we'll make that available. But I want to wrap up with just a big thank you to Marilyn, not only for participating in this webinar, but all the work that she continues to do around the country. It's making a big difference. And, you know, I'm truly appreciative. And I know many other people are as well. So thanks again, Marilyn. And, well, with that, we will wrap up.
All right. Thank you so much. And thank you to everybody who joined us. If you're interested in learning more about the Health Rosetta framework and would like to check out more case studies, please visit healthrosetta.org/friends for a free PDF copy of our book, The Opioid Crisis Wake-Up Call and the CEO's Guide to Restoring the American Dream. We will also include a link to those in the follow-up email next week, along with the recording of today's webinar. So on that note, that's it for me. Thank you again and have a great weekend.